Good morning, everybody. It is Thursday, March 26th, and this is the Education Sub of Ways and Means. And we are here with Higher Education. Mr. Cannon, we'll start with you. Doug Wilson, anything for the good of the order?
Just a reminder that public testimony on Oregon Opportunity Grant, Equity Lens, and financial aid related issues, affordability, are scheduled for Monday. And I believe we'll have it in this room for that particular day of public testimony.
Okay, Ben.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. And my role today will be largely just to introduce the person to my right. Do want to draw your attention again to the letter that we've submitted just this morning in response to some of the questions that arose yesterday. Please let us or me or a member of our staff know if you have questions about anything that we've supplied as follow-up. We have spent quite a bit of time over the first several days of our presentation describing our emphasis, the Commission's emphasis on improving the affordability of higher education. And today, really want to do a deeper dive on our specific proposals, budget proposals, and redesign proposals relative to the Oregon Opportunity Grant, the state's need-based aid program, and other ways in which the state of Oregon helps support scholarships for Oregonians. So Bob Brew is the director of Oregon's Office of Student Access and Completion. The office, as of last year, came underneath the HEC umbrella with its rules and authorities really lodged at the commission, but Bob leaving a really capable staff in Eugene that deploys the Opportunity Grant as well as our other scholarship programs that you'll hear about today, and Aspire, which you'll hear about either late today or next week. So with that, I'll turn it over to Bob.
Thanks.
Welcome back, Mr. Brew.
Thank you, Chairman Rowe. Good morning. For the record, my name is Bob Brew. I am the Executive Director of the Office of Student Access and Completion. So once again, good morning, Chairman Rowe, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here and to talk about the work that we do at OSAC. We are the state's, the arm of the HEC that's primarily responsible for state financial aid and student access, and it's the greatest job in the world. So the first thing I'm going to talk about is our flagship, the Oregon Opportunity Grant. This is our budget request, and it reflects our 2013 budget level and our 2015-17 agency request. And I'll be talking about that in a little bit more detail. So this slide that you've seen before, Mr. Cannon has presented. And I'll be talking today about the first bullet, which is the expansion and redesign strategy of the Oregon Opportunity Grant. And then on Monday, I'll be talking about the third bullet, which is post-secondary success in our Aspire program. So the Oregon Opportunity Grant is Oregon's primary, in fact, our only need-based financial aid program for low-income students. And we've been very successful. OSAC was started in 1959 primarily to operate a need-based grant program, and it's run in various incarnations since then. It's been very successful, as this data demonstrates. This is from the Oregon University System. Students that received the Oregon Opportunity Grant not only perform better than and complete at higher rates than their low-income peers, but as compared to all of their peers in general, it really truly does make a difference for those students. For those of you that have been around a few years, however, you're well aware that this program is severely underfunded. Most recent data, we've been able to fund about less than 24% of the students that are eligible based on the current methodology that determines eligibility. These are low and low middle income students. The need far outdistances the available resources. And as the statute was written, it didn't really provide a way to prioritize how funding should be awarded. So there was this big pool of students that were eligible, but nothing in the statute that says, if you don't have enough money, fund these students first. So as a result, the grants currently are awarded on a first-come, first-served basis. We open the application for the grant is the federal, or the free application for federal student aid, the FAFSA. That opens on January 1, and by February 1, give or take a day or two, we're out of money. We probably get...
So your family that has a family income of $65,000 has just as good a chance of getting support as one that, say, has income of $20,000?
Chairman Nero, that's correct. That's under the current methodology.
They're not prioritized at all, and yet we're only serving a fourth of those that are eligible. Seems like if we're only serving a fourth of those that are eligible, it ought to be the bottom fourth. I don't know.
So, thank you, Chairman Rowe. That's a great lead-in. I appreciate it. and I'll talk about that in a minute. But that was one of the frustrations when I became director: is how do we prioritize these? Because quite often the students, we found that students that applied first were actually the ones that were probably most prepared in that. They had college-educated parents or other networks of support that provided the incentive and the direction to get that form in early. And it was later that we started seeing the applications from first-generation students, lower-income students. So not only did a relatively higher-income student have the same opportunity as a very poor student, but often they had a better shot because they were better prepared to get their application in early.
Senator Roblin.
Along that same line, have you noticed the difference between those schools that are engaged in Aspire and getting them in sooner than those that don't have those kind of programs?
Chairman Rowe, Senator Roblin, thank you very much for another great lead-in. Yes. But we can't take all the credit because we really acknowledge the hard work that school counselors play in that effort. But our Aspire high school mentoring programs do a great job of keeping students on track and making sure that they get their FAFSAs filed early. In fact, this year we found that our efforts were so successful, and not just our efforts, but the efforts on high schools and college campuses were so successful that we saw the highest day one FAFSA application rates since we've been keeping track. And in fact, it was a 50% increase over last year. So we've got a lot of interest and a lot of support.
It's good to have Madam Co-Chair joining us. She's been testifying on a bill in another committee. Representative Huffman is next, and then you got it, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Bob, in 2013, you testified, and it started us down a path of, viewing a lot of stuff that we do against 40-40-20 and other goals that we have that may not be in statute, like, improving four-year graduation rate and things like that. We have a lot of goals that we don't necessarily have a statute to back it up, but on the opportunity grant, I wanted to start making sure that, particularly if we were going to invest more money, that we were tying that somehow, tracking degree completions. So I appreciate the work group and all the work, and I understand we're pretty much there getting ready to be able to do that. Another area in 2013 that I was really watching was making sure that our limited state dollars were last dollar as much as possible. And so along that line of thinking, is there anything that hopefully, and we can assume, but I hate to assume, that a student's going to go after Pell and any other type of thing first, or simultaneously, that it wouldn't just be the opportunity grant. But I would hope we're doing that. Also, in conjunction with that, is there any way on an application form that a student can relate something that would give your folks at OSAC a heads up that maybe they're eligible for something else that would relieve the opportunity grant? For example, an Oregon foster child that had aged out that's eligible for free college, higher ed. I just want to make sure that we're doing everything we can to identify other resources, because we do run out of OOG monies far too early, and I just would like to know a little bit about that process to make sure that we're counseling folks and getting other monies first, maybe, if they're eligible for them.
So, Senator Monroe, Representative Huffman, thank you. So, the model that we use for that is the shared responsibility model, and this is in statute. And it specifies that the responsibility for funding a student's education is a shared responsibility, primarily with the student and their family in first position. The federal government has a stake in that. The state has a stake in that. And it specifies specifically the expectations of each group. So the student is expected to provide a certain level of financial first dollar in, and it's based on a certain number of hours per year at the state's minimum wage as kind of the base. That's first dollar in. Then the second dollar in is the federal Pell Grant, if they're eligible. If they're not eligible for the Pell Grant, perhaps any federal tax credits that they're eligible for. Then if they go to a public university, we specify that there's a level of student borrowing that's expected. By statute, that doesn't exist in community college calculation of shared responsibility model. And then there's the expected family contribution, which is calculated as by the federal government as part of the FAFSA. And then in statute, it says specifically that the remaining gap belongs to the state. So all of those other things have to be taken into account before the state's share of assistance is calculated. One of the challenges has been that even as tuition, books, supplies, cost of living have increased, the state minimum wage that the student share is based on does not increase quickly. The Pell Grant does not increase nearly as quickly as inflation. Those tax credits don't increase as fast as inflation. Family income hasn't increased. While it's increased perhaps as approaching inflation, it hasn't increased nearly as fast as tuition. And so since the state is in last dollar position, that gap has grown over time. It's just the nature of the model. And so we have for several years, even though that gap for a very poor student may be $5,000 to $7,000, the state's maximum award has been capped at $2,000. So while the student and their family have responsibility for that first dollar in, then perhaps for an expected family contribution and loan, they're also responsible for that last dollar that the state can't contribute.
Follow up,
Madam Chair. And I'm glad to hear that it's in the framework where state dollars are are the last dollar in. I think that's wise. With limited resources, that's where it needs to be. But is there anywhere along the process to allow a student to self-identify as a aged out foster child or the dependent of a deceased or 100% disabled veteran? Bills that we have passed, and we pass something pretty much every session that identifies a new population that's eligible for pretty much free college. So, but we had a hearing last year, I think, during the short session, that we asked specifically in the Ed Policy Committee how many foster youth that have aged out have taken advantage of free college since 2011 or whenever it was we passed that bill. And there had been about 80 that had participated at to some degree in that. And the program had been in place a full 2 or 3 years at that point from implementation. And so as we do pass things like military dependents, parent deceased because of, you know, war stuff, or 100% disabled, as we have those things, I'm always asking the question, how do we allow these students to identify or become aware of the fact that they could have this benefit? I'd hate to think that we were giving $1,500 this year to somebody that was actually eligible for much more on a different path.
Sure. Senator Monroe, Co-Chair Comp, and Representative Huffman, thank you. So that's a big question. So we have, under our administration, we cooperate with the Department of Human Services with former foster youth that they identify. They know all the former foster youth in the state, and we work with them. Those students, for the most part, are eligible for the CHAFE Education and Training Grant, which is a federal grant. I believe the maximum amount under that is about $3,000. By statute, those students are also prioritized for eligibility to the Oregon Opportunity Grant. So the February 1 deadline does not necessarily apply to them. And so if their costs aren't covered for tuition and fees under those two programs, then the colleges and universities are required to give them a tuition waiver. But as you know, tuition is only a fifth to a quarter of the total cost of attendance. And so, but by statute, they are prioritized for opportunity grant awards. I'm not familiar with the program for children of deceased veterans. We do have a program for children of deceased and disabled first responders, firefighters, and police officers. That's another program that, to use the expression, it's a carve out of the opportunity grant funds, but it's at a much higher level. It covers, I believe, 90% of cost of attendance, but let me verify that. So, so over the course of the last year, at the last legislative session, the legislature directed the Oregon Education Investment Board to look at the Oregon Opportunity Grant, particularly to address the issue that Senator Monroe brought forward. How are we prioritizing these dollars? And so a work group was formed that was chaired by Larry Roper, to kind of look at the structure, look at how we could prioritize without drastically changing the existing statute, leaving that intact. And that group met, made recommendations to a design group that was made up primarily of financial aid professionals. I used the analogy that first work group was the architect, and they handed it off to the general contractor, which was this design team made of financial aid professionals, to come up with some strategies to address those needs. Under the work group's direction, the proposal, which is in House Bill 2407, I believe the -2 amendments, specifies that students with the highest need, as calculated by their expected family contribution on the FAFSA, would be first in line for the opportunity grant. That students that were successful in applying and getting the grant the first year, provided they continued to meet satisfactory academic progress and met income eligibility, would be essentially guaranteed the grant the second year. This was to address a problem that we had, that students might apply 1 year, get the grant, be a little late the next year, and be out of luck. And so there was no financial security with that source. So this was another issue that we attempted to address. The third thing that we attempted to address was this early application deadline. As I mentioned, it often shut out students, the students that were most trying to help, which was the lowest income students. And so by focusing on the lowest income students, we were able to extend that deadline out. The exact date hasn't been modeled yet, but we expect it to be at least as late as April, if not into June. We've asked, and the Higher Education Coordinating Commission has put forth a request that was supported by the governor's budget to increase the budget for the Oregon Opportunity Grant to $143.3 million. This represents about a 26% increase in total funding. We expect to be able to serve an additional 16,000 students, which is approximately a 25% increase in the number of students. These are the sources of funds from 2013-15, primarily general funds, although there's a small smallish allocation out of the lottery funds. Mr. McGee can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it's a proportion of the interest from the Education Stability Fund. And for 13-15, we expect that we will be able to serve about 70,000 students and award about $114 million. This grant just shows the percentage of recipients and the percentage of dollars depending on the sector. So the green represents community colleges. The tan represents the Oregon University System schools or the public universities. And the dark brown represents the private nonprofit students that participate in the program. And you can see there's a difference. The reason there are more recipients at the community college and slightly fewer dollars at the community college is because they have a large proportion or a larger proportion of their students that are attending half time. So they're counted once at recipients, but counted essentially at a half award amount under the dollars disbursed. You saw this slide yesterday from Mr. Buchanan. Just demonstrates kind of the eligible applicants versus the recipients. And as we expressed, the eligible applicants are students that have met all the requirements for the opportunity grant under the shared responsibility model. They are they're Oregon residents. They meet the income requirements. They don't have a bachelor's degree. They've indicated they want to attend an Oregon college or university that's eligible to receive the grant, and so on. So, and the brown line represents the students that have actually showed up at school and picked up the money. I'd like to now be able to move on to show you to tell you about a few other programs that OSAC administers. I mentioned earlier the CHAPE Education and Training Grant. This is primarily for...
Bob, what page are you on?
I'm sorry. This is slide 28.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Yeah, I kind of skipped through that one. This is a federal funded program, and it's specifically for former foster youth to assist them in education. 190 students have participated this year. The Scholarship for Children of Deceased and Disabled Public Safety Officers. This is full tuition and fees. Representative Huffman, I correct myself. Full tuition and fees at an Oregon university, or equivalent to tuition and fees at the U of O if they're going to a private Oregon institution. And 11 students participated. And then the Oregon Student Child Care Grant. This is a grant for students that have a child that they put in care while they're at school. It's a small program, but very meaningful to the folks that participate. And that's state funded. Jobs Plus, this is really a program that we had simply monitor funds on behalf of I believe the employment department. These are folks that are returning to the workforce and are getting some support, and when they go to work for an agency or a company, that agency or company puts $1 per hour into an education account for them that they can then, they or their family members can then access for up to 5 years after completing the program. And we hold those funds for them. If after 5 years, if they haven't accessed those funds, then they are turned over to and distributed as part of the Oregon Opportunity Grant. The Oregon Youth Conservation Corps, kind of a similar thing. These are scholarship vouchers that we handle on behalf of the Youth Conservation Corps. The Barber and Hairdressers mm-hmm. Grant, this is always one that's a little bit strange. At one point in the past, I believe it was 20 years ago, for some reason, the state overcharged for licenses for barbers and hairdressers, and for whatever reason, rather than refunding the money, they established an endowment, and the interest from the endowment is distributed to the various barber and hairdresser schools across the state that they can award as scholarships. And since it's only the interest from this account, they vary from $100 to on low interest years to up to $1,000 on when interest rates are high. So those are our publicly funded programs. We're also very fortunate. OSAC acts as the administering agent for privately funded scholarships for the Oregon Community Foundation and the Ford Family Foundation. The Oregon Community Foundation is one of the largest statewide foundations in the country. The Ford Family Foundation is one of the largest privately run endowments in the country. And so we're very fortunate to be able to administer their scholarships for them. We also administer a large number of smaller privately funded scholarships on behalf of donors across the state. And we're only one of two states that that do something like this. It's a great benefit for the student because the student can go onto our website and apply up to 500 different scholarship programs with one application. About $18 million were awarded, are being awarded this year to about 3,500 students, and we've just added in over the last year about 33 new scholarships. Mm-hmm. These are some of our goals associated with the scholarship program, but we're always looking for opportunities to not only
Smith Warner.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Just a quick question. So do the foundations pay the OSAC's administrative costs or something? Like pay for dedicated staff to do that? I think that's great. I'm already taking notes for the 8 years from now when my children will be applying for school, but that's wonderful. But it just makes me wonder.
Thank you. Co-Chairs, Representative Smith Warner, thank you. Yes. We do charge administrative costs for these for administering the scholarships, and we just hired an outside auditor to assess our cost recovery on these. They actually did a desk audit with each employee to determine how much of their cost was associated with this program. We actually made some staffing tweaks, but it's a cost recovery model. It has been. And that's our intention that it will continue to be. So I mentioned much of this, but the just what our scholarship involves, basically our application. There's a student profile, some personal statements, which are short essays, a chart of activities that students participate in, transcripts. These are kind of the basics of the scholarship application, and then various scholarships can ask for more information. I think we have one scholarship that asks for a copy of your prior year's hunting license. Another scholarship might require you, your parents, to provide a union card because it's sponsored by the union. So there's a variety of scholarships, and virtually anybody can qualify for at least one of them. Some of them are merit-based, some are income-based, some are affiliation-based. Some of them are for specifically for community colleges, some are for universities. We have one that's specifically for Artisan College. If you wanted to learn how to make classical guitars, the scholarship would be the scholarship that you would get. So there's a variety of programs, and it's really exciting to be able to talk about them and tell people about them. This kind of shows the history of the awardees per year and the scholarships awarded over the prior years. In a lot of cases, these are endowments, and so the amount of money that they can award is in some level related to the interest rate that they're receiving on their funds.
Before you move on, Bob, do you have any idea how much private universities that have pretty good size foundations award to students?
Madam Co-Chair, I don't.
Okay. I would see it'd be difficult to, like Pacific University, to find out or know what their scholarships are. Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And because we do have some parents that have kids approaching this and the comments that were made, that the list of scholarships that are go wanting, no one applies for them because of the conditions that there are, is enormous. And as a parent, you need to figure out what are those attributes in your family. You know, did my ancestor come from Scotland and whatever? I mean, it's amazing how many scholarships. If you like to golf in your family and your kid decides to be a caddy in the last year of his high school, there are amazing scholarships for caddies. So it is really important, and OSAC has done a better job than we've ever done in the state with respect to doing that, but many of them are not done by OSAC, but you can find them through different places, and OSAC can help you as a parent find where to look to identify those kinds of things once you've identified what are special about our family, because it's absolutely remarkable. And we will hear more about some other programs that help kids do that. But as a parent, it's really important to be proactive in looking at the kinds of things. And I was chuckling to myself as I thought through the number of ones that kids at our school have gotten because people identified them for them. And they weren't just the ones that were just mentioned. But don't forget there's an opportunity out there for parents and others to find some amazing scholarship opportunities, many of which sit and grow because no one accesses them.
Senator Roblin, I thought you were giving an advertisement for Band and Dunes.
They do a really good job if you happen to be a caddy there outside my district, so I don't take any, just barely, but have a long deal. And they changed the world for our kids because they knew about this scholarship, and they made sure that kids that came and wanted a caddy and got part of it had the opportunity to know about it. And all of a sudden, there were a number of scholarships from our communities of Band and Coos Bay where kids made the effort to be out there and do that and ended up with some really good scholarships, not ever intending to be golfers other than personally. But that's not the criteria. The criteria is that you did the other thing. So anytime I can for Band and Dunes, I will. But they have been helpful in helping kids understand that there are some opportunities for them.
Co-Chair, Senator Roblin, thank you very much for that. That's true. There are a lot of opportunities for scholarships out there, but my staff will kick me if I get back to the office and I don't mention never pay for scholarship information.
Exactly. That's true. That's also
that,
true.
That information is available free. If anyone wants to charge you for it,
perfect,
move along. So thank you. This shows our budget. Specifically related to the disbursements that we send to students associated with them. You can see the grants, the scholarship funds, the Oregon Opportunity Grant. One thing that's not on here because it operates a little bit differently is the scholarships that we administer for the Ford Family Foundation. They represent another $8 million, but because their scholarship awards don't actually pass through our books, they're not shown on here, but they are included in the previous slides that I've shared with you. And lastly, these are some of the key performance measures that we're working on in our new role as a part of the HEC. I won't go through them at all because I'll be coming back to you with some data on them, but looking at average debt for students with a bachelor's degree, students that are attending college, they're finding unaffordable costs and so on. That's all I had for today, but I'll be back to talk to you about Aspire, I believe, on Monday or Tuesday.
And Madam Co-Chair, before we invite some of the institutional representatives to comment on these affordability programs or others, I just want to note the office that Bob leads, in order to do this work, in order to get 100 some million dollars in the hands of the right students in a timely way, under the parameters of and differing parameters of hundreds of different types of awards, has significant administrative responsibilities. It executes those very effectively with lean staff, relying on a quite robust IT infrastructure. We're talking about an office that receives from the feds the FAFSAs of all Oregon students, and uses those to determine, among other things, the qualification for the Oregon Opportunity Grant. High levels of security needs. One of the budget requests that we have relates to the IT infrastructure. We'll come back to that later in our. In our presentation to you, but I do want to flag for now the fact that this is a office with important administrative responsibilities for these scholarship programs. They do so with a relatively few staff. They do rely, as noted, on funding in part from the private organizations for whom they administer scholarships, but also there is a general fund component and there is a pretty significant data and IT infrastructure that requires ongoing maintenance and upkeep.
Well, I want to thank you, Bob, and Ben, because a couple of years ago, people sat at this dais and really said, I don't see how you can put these two departments together, that they had been separate for many years. And so it's good news for our students and our institutions, so thank you. And Senator Roblin.
Just another little clarification that I it's really been neat that the and they mentioned at the end the Ford Family Foundation, which most people know as the Roseburg Lumber group and their family.
If we didn't, we know now.
Exactly. Wanted to make sure that people knew that. Number two, they have a very, very extensive process to select their people. And I don't know that there's any that's as selective as their process, the interviews, all the other things that they do. And OSAC runs all that. And it if you don't know about it, you need to ask some people who have been involved, because it's as impressive a process as I think you could have for awarding scholarships based on multiple criteria. And OSAC does a really great job. We've got at least one member of the legislature who has been on some of those teams, so there's other people you can talk to. But I'm just saying it's really an impressive thing that they do. So,
yeah.
And OSAC has really been instrumental in providing the credibility of an institution that will do it, unlike any other state, I think. So I just want to make sure we appreciate the work that you have done.
Thank you. Okay, Ben, on next. So are you going to introduce our next people, Ben, or how are we going to do this?
I think they're on the list, right? So
well, they're on the agenda, yes.
Great. So we'll have about
so that. We have Doug Sievers, David McDonald, and some community colleges representatives.
Bone. And that would be Andrew Bone. I'm sorry.
Andrew?
We got the name this morning. And Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, a couple of them have slides. And if you want to follow on your computer, they're under today's meeting. And I think I know that the OSU and Western people have presentation slides that would be fine. I don't know. Julie, can you help them? Thank you.
And for new members on this committee, these are some familiar faces to us, most of us, and they too bring a tremendous amount of experience in working with their institutions and helping our students be successful. So who's up? Okay, so Andrew? No.
Doug.
Doug.
We'll have Doug.
Okay.
Thank you, Co-Chair Comp and Monroe and the committee members. For the record, I'm Doug Sievers. I'm the Director of Financial Aid Scholarships at Oregon State University. And I'm just going to go over some of the efforts we have done to work with affordability. I have my PowerPoint here. And the first one is one you've talked about already today is the Oregon Opportunity Grant. And we're using that to leverage the federal Pell Grant funds and other federal funds, the Oregon Opportunity Grant, and then we come in with OSU money to pay all the students' tuition fees. So we do this each year, and it's very dependent on what levels the Oregon Opportunity Grant is to help these students. About 49%, just half the students, receive additional gift money to help cover books and supplies. So we think that's very helpful to them. One thing we found that the persistence rate of these students are 11% higher than students who have less grant aid. So we're seeing how grant aid has a definite impact on persistence. Also, we're showing that they graduate with $4,000 less of loan debt. So you're seeing that these students are graduating with loanless debt and or more are graduating. So it's very important grant money makes an impact. We usually award 2,600 to 2,800 students a year, and that depends on what the level of OOG awarding is, because the Pell Grant's fairly stable on eligibility. And that's why I think it's so important that the OOG is stable from year to year on the level. And increase, of course, because the more students that receive OOG, the more Bridge to Success students that we can award. So this is our main affordability program, and it can expand as the OOG expands.
Thank you.
Let's see.
Do you have more slides?
Yes.
Awesome.
Page down.
I won't kick you off the dais yet, then.
Hang on here. It didn't do it. There we go. Same slide. Let's try. Okay.
There we go.
One of the things we've in the last couple years, I had one of my staff members. He's in a graduate program, and he needed a project, and we like to do projects in regard to financial aid. So we started the student loan debt project, where we wanted to further analyze the impact of student loans on our students and break it down by college so we can get an idea. So we could look at what are they graduating with on their earnings potential, how's that match up with their loan debt level. So we went and my staff member, graduate student, he went out and collected the data in regard to that. And then we met with each of the colleges to go over that debt. So one of the things we're trying to address is there was so much publicity about the maximum loan debt students were taking out. You know, the publicity that all these students were graduating with hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt. Granted, there are some students out there that do that, but most students graduate from OSU with a reasonable amount of debt. Right now, students graduate with a little less than $25,000 in debt. It's a payment around $270 a month. And for the salaries that OSU students generally receive, it's a reasonable 10-year repayment. But we wanted to go and look at it by college. So we want to address this issue in regard to having students feel like, you know, they're getting a reasonable debt and they'll have an occupation that can help pay for it. We also wanted the colleges, because they have fundraisers out looking for scholarships for students. We wanted to deal with them, show them how their scholarships impact the debt level, because we could see it. Some colleges have more scholarships than others. So you could see that, and then we could show all the colleges. It kind of gave them incentive to go out and find more scholarships and work harder in regard to that. And also, in regard to the Financial Aid Literacy Council, we also started an effort to create more financial literacy on campus. We wanted our students to be more financial literate so they, when they got out, they could budget their money better and to handle their student loans. So we went out, asked the campus community, because I think it's more of a total campus community effort. It should be, not just a financial aid effort. And we had a very good response by the community. We had 15 different groups on campus meeting. We've broken out by committees. So what we're doing now is trying to set up a central focus. It could be an office. It could be a staffing in an office to get literacy out. We're tying that together with our student debt project so we can funnel that money to the colleges so they can get that information out to their students. Business College is doing a lot in helping us in regard to that. So besides you know, having OG for affordable, we're trying to educate our students and handle their money better, and we're trying to get our colleges to raise more scholarships along with our foundation. Here we go. And these are various things that we're doing, other things. We have an early warning system for at-risk students. What we found that I normally think that students who get into financial aid trouble would come to the financial aid office, and we're not always finding that as true. So we have different areas on campus who work with students, would be the health center, our counseling center, because they'll come in and part of the issue they're finding is financial. So they're directing us so we can look at what little loan money, what little scholarship money, what little grant money. So we want these students to persist, and we don't want a small amount of, or a large amount of money. We want the students in our office, and it's been very successful to direct these students so we can help them. We've adopted the federal shopping sheet that helps students compare OSU with other schools. The shopping sheet puts the student's financial aid award in a format that can be compared with other schools in regard to cost of education. What we do is when we send out our award letter, we link with this federal shopping sheet, and then students can go to that, and they can see how OSU relates to other schools. Then they can make a decision, is OSU right for them in regard to the aid they've been awarded, because it takes their actual financial aid and puts us into this federal shopping sheet. So that's been very successful. The net price calculator, that's even before students are awarded financial aid. They can come into our OSU financial aid webpage, and they can plug in some financial information about their family and then get an idea of what kind of grant and debt they will have at OSU. It gives them an idea. It can't get too specific because they're just inputting what they believe their parents' adjusted gross income and such is. But it's a good, you know, it gives them an idea.
Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Co-Chair Kopp. So regarding the shopping sheet, I think we've come to learn that A lot of the debt that students incur is due to living expenses, and some of the decisions that students make, they're young, going to school, and there's different options that they can choose from regarding which dormitory they're going to live in, what kind of expenses they're going to be incurring, and understanding the long-term consequences of those decisions. Do you have a shopping sheet for explaining to the students, hey, if you pick this kind of these living accommodations versus the nicer one, and who wouldn't want to live in a nicer dorm room than in a lesser one, but right. What that will cost them in the long run, and trying to encourage kids who maybe don't have the resources to maybe choose a cheaper living option?
Well, in conjunction with housing has opened up a lot of triple rooms.
Yes.
And we really stress that with students, that these triple rooms are available. I've actually worked with students in and gone through their housing. I said, do you know they have triple rooms? They kind of miss that. And then they actually move to the triple rooms. Mm. So we're putting that as part of our literature in regard Good. To housing options and working with housing. They're also providing some discounts in housing in regard to need. That is a factor that we're really concerned with, because housing is a major factor in the cost of education.
Just follow up.
Yes.
So is there a shopping sheet or something specific, or is it just on a individual case basis? Or?
It's information the housing office provides the student.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So it sounds like this Bridge to Success program is focused on, I don't want to say a certain population, a finite number of students. It says 2,600 to 3,200 here. My question is, how long has the process or the program been in place? And what I'm driving to is, it says here that the Bridge to Success students persist at 11.3% higher rate. I'm wondering really what persist means.
Okay.
And do we then have the data to say their graduation rate is 11.3% higher?
Co-Chairs Monroe and Comp and Representative Springer, persist would be graduation rate. They're going on to graduate more than the group that does not receive it. So the program started before I came to OSU, which I've been here just about 6 years. I'm thinking it's about 8 years that we've had Bridge Success as a program.
So, I don't know if I missed this. Is this just for undergrad students?
This is for just undergrad students.
Okay, so undergrad students involved in this are graduating at 11% higher rate than other students?
Of other students who have less grant funds.
Okay.
Yeah. One of the things we've done is expand our financial aid workshops. We do workshops for the high schools around Corvallis, application workshops. We've also do workshops on campus, and specifically we'll start doing workshops on student loan debt level, especially when we're looking, you know, this is the time when students are thinking about graduation. So we'll have some special workshops. We'll contact students directly. I know you had expressed interest on what students receive in regard to loan counseling. And we try to stress that and reach out to especially juniors and seniors and then graduating students for next spring term. We also, when the students come to campus for orientation with their parents, we have special workshops for the parents in regard to what the students will be going through in regard to their bill, what the parents can do in regard to that. We feel that's really helpful because sometimes a good share of the time the parents are driving force in regard to helping students with their finances. So that's been a very helpful activity. And then we do have work with the accounting group, our student accounting group, for to go out to classrooms and provide a one-day consumer education regard. Professors will slot a day or two that go out and work with, on financial counseling with students. One program we didn't put up there, we've had for such a long time that I think we take it for granted, is our degree partnership program, where students can finish off first 2 years of their academic program at a community college, and that is much cheaper, and we usually have around 6,000 students in the DPP program out of our student body, so that's a very good program for students. So, thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate the information. I'm going to send one of my granddaughters the shopping sheet.
There you go.
Yeah, she needs it desperately. David?
Good morning. Co-Chair Comp, Co-Chair Monroe, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dave McDonald. I am the Associate Provost at Western Oregon University. I only have two slides to work you through, and hopefully I won't screw that up too badly. I want to provide some larger context in terms of why we do what we do at the university, as well as kind of share with you that the comments that my colleague has made, they strike home for me. I have a high school senior, which seems hardly possible given the fact I remember when he was just this tall. Now he's 6'6" and has the debt load of a 6'6" kid. So I do understand from both a parent perspective as well as a higher ed person this really complicated environment we've created for our kids and families to try to navigate. And it's complicated because, again, it has federal dollars. It has state dollars when they're available, has institutional practices, has private dollars, and a lot of confusion. So for Western, we're going to start with the year 2007 as kind of our starting point, because one of our keystone projects, the Western Tuition Promise, started in that year, so it's a good year zero to use as a comparison. Since we started that project, the general fund support from the state has dropped by $2.4 million. That's our current budget this year versus what we had in the 2007 year. We actually had years where the cuts were greater than that. There's been a slight rebounding, but it's a $2.4 million cut. The only way we recover from cut is to reduce our services, which have a dramatic impact on our students, and raise tuition. So in that same time period, we've increased tuition by $3,000, which is over 50%. And that's been a very painful response we've had to put in place, because we know that directly affects affordability for our students and families. The opportunity grant in Oregon has only increased by $250 in that time period. Our fee remission, which is our institutional scholarships, basically if we were a private institution, we'd call it a discount rate. But our fee remission has increased, as you can see, by $1.3 million in that time period. And we've grown by 1,000 students. So our enrollment has grown, our support from the state has decreased, the opportunity grant has struggled to keep pace, and what this slide doesn't reflect is the fact that only one out of four students who are eligible for the opportunity grant even get the opportunity grant. So not only is the award too small, but the number of students supported by the opportunity grant are too few. The Pell Grant has grown some, but again, that has not experienced growth anywhere near the need to counter that. So as a result, student debt has increased. And I'm hitting the down button to see if we can get this to move.
Senator Roblin.
So is the $3,000 increase, is that per year or per term?
That is an annual increase, Senator Roblin, and that's for Oregon residents. So as my colleague sits here and play with the PowerPoint, and we have Julie, the real expert, come over and really get it right for us. Technology, isn't it wonderful? What you would find if my colleagues from other campuses came up and presented their similar data, the picture would be quite comparable, perhaps with more green or yellow or orange in their photos or their slides, but the overall picture would paint an equally challenged environment. Reduced state funding resulting in increased tuition, resulting in decreased affordability for our students. For this current year, we've awarded $3 million in fee remissions to our students. Almost all of that is need-based. Three-quarters of our students receive financial aid based on economic need. About half of our students receive a Pell Grant. So we serve a group of students that have very much the same economic profile as many of our community colleges. And that is by design of the institution. We very much focus on access and serving Oregon students. In 2007, we implemented the Tuition Promise. And in fact, my president and I spent a lot of time here in Salem talking to your colleagues who were in your positions at that time, explaining this program because it was very different. One of the things that the promise does is it guarantees families and students a four-year guarantee their tuition will not increase. We lock in that rate. Now, it's locked in at the per-credit rate, so if a student takes 15 credits one term and 14 the next, there'll be a variance in that term-to-term tuition, but the per-credit rate will not have changed. It's just basically buying two cups of coffee versus one cup of coffee, same price for the cup. We made it very clear to the legislature that we could only sustain this program if the legislature and the state were able to sustain funding for the university. That clearly has not happened. As a result, we were forced in 2013 to change the program to the tuition choice. A little semantics in name, we basically told students no longer were every freshman going to come in with a locked promise. We now gave students a choice of picking the promise rate, which starts at a higher rate, or taking a traditional package, which has an increasing tuition rate every year. It's similar to an adjustable rate mortgage versus a fixed rate mortgage. You're going to pay a little more to buy in and lock in that price, that security of knowing that your rate won't increase over time. About half of our students are able to pick the higher price. We know more would want to because the stability is really a peace of mind and is important to families. That program continues to be successful. We found that in the first year we implemented the promise, 2007, when we tracked those students through graduation, they paid on average $1,000 less per student than they would have had we not had the promise in place. So not only did the promise give students and their families stability, but it also gave them cost savings, which was really an important part.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Was that $1,000 less overall, $1,000 a year?
$1,000 less overall, and what we find is our students who are seniors pay the lowest tuition rate in the state, in some cases by a significant amount. However, as freshmen, they pay a higher rate because it, over time, the rates catch up.
Senator Roblin.
In that promise, if they took 5 years to get through school, did they pay the fifth year, they would pay at the new rate?
Senator Roblin, members of the committee, the way the program is set up is that we have some extensions for a fifth year depending on major. If they are in a major that requires 5 years, accounting, for instance, because of the CPA exam requirements, they serve in the military, and a few other exceptions, the fifth year would be locked into the same rate as the prior years. Otherwise, they would pay a rate that was slightly above what they paid the first 4 years. We don't drive them over a cliff, but there is a bump, and the bump's designed to give an incentive to get them out. If you pay a little more, you want to perhaps get the accelerator a little faster as a student and graduate a little sooner.
Okay.
Moving on, in 2010, we implemented a textbook savings program. Mm-hmm. As my colleague mentioned, tuition is just a portion of the cost of going to school. Roughly, it's a third of the cost, and thereabouts. Textbooks are a hidden cost. I know that you and your colleagues have had many hearings on textbook costs, trying to manage them. We're doing our best to manage them on our end as well. So we put in a textbook rental program. Think of it as Redbox. Why buy a book that you're not going to keep when you can rent it instead? So the rental rate's right around 30 to 35% of the actual cost of purchase. As long as the student returns it in rental shape, we don't charge them extra. We also extend that to scientific calculators. A lot of our classes use clickers so that if we had a clicker in your hand right now, we'd prompt you with some questions to see if you're awake, if you're learning the material, what I had to, as an instructor, had to go back and cover again because it was clear you missed that part. So it's a way for us to have a feedback in a larger class. Those clickers cost, we rent them as well. So a number of things that we do rent. We find that that rental program is generating about $500,000 annually in savings directly to our students. That rental program covers undergraduate and graduate programs. The biggest barrier to that is when we have publications or publishers that change textbooks more rapidly than we can have a rental recovery rate. We need to rent a book about 10 times to recover the rate, both of lost revenue to the bookstore as well as the actual cost of the book. When they go every 2 years, we can't put them in the rental cycle because there's no way we can recover the cost of that book with the rental rates as they are. 2013, we introduced a financial literacy program with the MAPS, MAPS Community Foundation of the MAPS local bank here. I'm sorry
Credit
on that.
Union.
Credit Union, thank you. My membership card just got revoked. And that was really aimed at helping our freshmen make wise decisions the moment they walked on campus. So the financial literacy is part of a new student week in orientation and in the residence halls. We have programming that these peer mentors are trained by our MAPS colleagues to do really informed, good decision-making by our students so that they don't have to feel as though they need to buy the latest iPhone or the biggest gigabyte plan or go out to dinners often, but that there are consequences to the choices, the triple dorm room or the double room, that these consequences not only affect their day-to-day life today, but have a debt ratio problem for the student as well. So we really try to work with our students to help them make informed choices, because many of our students, this is the first time they've actually been away from mom and dad, had the choice to how to spend the money they had, have loan money that seems like, oh my God, look at this money, I have this check that's got zeros behind it. What do I do with it? We want them to make wise choices so they have fewer debts and fewer loans. And that's been a great partnership with MAPS Credit Union. And finally, the Willamette Promise, which is a dual credit program. We charge students $30 per year for as many credits as they can earn through a proficiency model. The average student taking just one class of four credits is going to save over $500 by virtue of the Willamette Promise. This is through the Willamette ESD, and it's a piece of the Eastern Replication Grant that OEIB allowed us to develop. It's a phenomenal program, and it's a way, it's not only open doors for students to go to college, but actually reduce the final cost of those students. The final fact I want to leave you is that the net result of everything that's happened in Oregon is that the average student today is in debt at an amount of $28,000, is what the average undergraduate student who has loans with their debt load in Oregon is. That's $6,000 higher than it was in 2007. So as a state, we've really missed our mark. We have failed to really make college even equally affordable, and we've made it less affordable to our students at a time in which 40-40-20 really pressures and mandates that we create a more educated population that gives us sustainability. So for us, we're doing what we can, but our affordability measures are very much reflected by what you're able to give us in terms of funding. The more support we receive from the state, the less tuition we have to charge our students, and that has a direct impact on affordability.
Thank you, Dr. McDonald. Any other questions? Okay, community colleges. Let's hear for the team.
Good morning, co-chairs and members of the community. My name is Andrew Bone. I'm the Vice President of Administration and Governance at Chemeketa Community College here in Salem. You've heard from my colleagues at other institutions about the challenges and how they've increased the last few years for our students in this area of affordability. And so I don't want to repeat some of the approaches that various institutions have taken to help with this. One thing I just wanted to touch on briefly this morning is one of the, I think, more interesting things that Chemeketa is doing to attack affordability. We obviously realize our tuition is less than the universities, and many of our students don't face the housing challenges that they do when they go away to a four-year university. We've zeroed in on the cost of textbooks, which has received quite a bit of press recently. And we've tried to approach the cost of textbooks by first really rethinking how we think about our own bookstore. Previously, we would look at that as possibly a profit center, and it did generate revenue, significant revenue. We have somewhat abandoned the idea that our bookstore is there for profit. And so we've tried to approach it that way. So in addition to having a lending library for where students who are on a path to success, so on a path to completion and graduation, can check a book out at no cost. We've invested somewhere around $100,000 in that lending library, and we have a rental program similar to the one Dave mentioned at Western. In addition to that, we have just begun exploring. Some of you I know have participated in some of the testimony around open educational resources, where a large number of dollars have been invested by public entities and private foundations in making textbook content available for free online. It has not been adopted as well as many people thought it would. We are trying to aggressively get free educational materials adopted into our classes by our faculty. Starting this term for us, we have a full-time faculty member who has a lot of experience in self-publishing books, working with our faculty to bridge that gap. That seems to be where it breaks down, as these open educational resources are available online, and they're free, and they've been tested, and they've been used, and they've been approved by various universities, for example, in math. We're trying to focus on high-cost, high-traffic classes. So our entry-level math courses, for example, our entry-level writing courses would be another one, to attack this issue of high textbook costs. You know, it's not unusual. We have a textbook that's used at our college that is $150 for a writing manual. The faculty member that I just spoke of has developed his own, and it's being adopted not only at Shemeketa but at other institutions, and it sells for $15. So we, one of the other parts of our exploration is that we are considering becoming our own publisher and publish textbooks that are developed by our faculty. The faculty has gotten quite excited about this. Our collective bargaining unit for the faculty has embraced it. The faculty senate has embraced the idea. And rather than get it hung up in bureaucracy, we've really tried to make it a streamlined process, so when people come forward with a good idea, we try to support them. So I thought that might be an interesting thing for the committee to hear about, one of the things that just Shemeketa is doing to address affordability.
Thank you. Questions for this panel of experts? Well, thank you for your time and your travels to come here today. And
thank you.
I am embarrassed to say, but the OSU girls basketball,
yeah,
how did they finish up?
Pretty they got beat.
They what?
They got beat.
They got beat. Uh-huh.
Pretty sad.
Gonzaga.
Gonzaga?
Yeah.
Those darn Catholics.
Where their coach's daughter was going to school.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Where their coach's daughter was going to school.
Didn't want
to
be.
Oh.
Oregon State's coach's daughter.
Got it. Okay, Doug, what does our future look like now that I've blasted Catholics? But
again, Monday is public testimony day for these subjects that you've heard over the past two or three days. And then we move on to, I believe, work for or the Aspire program and some of the other financial assistance stuff, and then moving on to workforce and community colleges probably later next week.
And this afternoon, what are we going to do? The full?
Full is at 4, and there's just little bill up 5017, I believe.
5017. Yes. So, yes. Co-Chair Monroe.
Yeah, question for Mr. Cannon. My understanding is that Lynn Benton has a program with OSU where students can actually at the same time take credits both at Lynn Benton and at Oregon State. My question is, how is that working out? What are the advantages of it? And are there other community colleges and universities that are doing something similar? For example, we just heard from Shemeketa. Well, Shemeketa is pretty close to Western. It seems to me it might work there. Portland State and PCC certainly should have options like that. I just wondered if there are advantages to that. If so, why don't we do it across the state, not just Lynn Benton and Oregon State?
And Mr. Co-Chair, did you want that discussion today or
no,
part of his?
No, it doesn't need to be today. Question for follow up, yeah.
I enjoyed watching Jux.
I wanted to make sure Mr. Cannon had something to do this weekend.
Thank you.
Other than
appreciate
take
it.
Care of his family. Well, with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 5024. And members, we are adjourned. We are adjourned.